Okay, so we're going to get started. I'm so happy to see. Boy, this is. I'm glad I'm not your school teacher. I'm glad you're a chatty bunch. So, but I want to give our keynote speaker this morning a lot of time to speak because she's going to talk to you, as you can see, about the art of relevance, which we're all very interested in. So I'm delighted to welcome Nina Simon. She's an internationally recognized expert on active community participation in cultural institutions and has been named a museum visionary by Smithsonian Magazine for her innovative approach to design. Nina received the American Alliance for Museums Nancy Hanks Memorial Award in 2012 and was named one of the 50 most powerful and influential people in nonprofit arts by the Western States Arts Federation in 2012 and 2013. She's the author of The Participatory Museum and the popular Museum 2.0 blog. She holds a BS from Worcester Polytechnic Institute, so there's a connection there because those are always connected, you know, same ideals as mechanics institutes. Yeah. And she has her degree in electrical engineering and mathematics. And she loves waking up to the redwoods every day. She lives down in beautiful Santa Cruz. So let's give her a hand and welcome Nina for driving down.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for having me. I always feel like my favorite learning experiences are when I'm with people who I consider to be cousins to my own experience. So, you know, when we're always with the people having the same conversations we always have, we don't break out in the ways we sometimes do when we're with people who are adjacent and pursuing the same goals but in different places. So I'm really honored to get to be with you today. I'm going to share some this morning about this idea of relevance. It's connected to a new book that I have out. I did bring copies of books and would love to sell one to you, sign later. No tax if you buy it today. No shipping. But I've been really curious over the last year to deeply explore this question of relevance. I don't know about you, but I've been at many conferences, not just in museums, which is where I work, but libraries, parks, theaters, community centers, where the very first thing that happens is somebody, an important person, stands up in the front of the room and says, "We have to make our work relevant." And everybody kind of nods, and there's this sense of both hope and maybe dread, but there isn't, in my experience at least, often a deeper dive into what it means when we say that, and why we care about relevance, and what it might do for us, for our institutions, and for our communities. And so I, over the last year, went on this journey to try and learn more about what relevance is, and why it might matter in my work, why it might matter in all of our work. I'll say that I'm approaching this idea of relevance in two ways. Institutionally, how can we make our institutes, our libraries, our museums relevant in the communities where we work? But also personally, how do we decide every day as individuals what is relevant to us and what isn't? Why did we decide to get on airplanes and get up in the morning and be here at this conference? Why do we decide to wear what we wear, to do what we do? And I really believe that these two ways of looking at it, institutionally and individually, that you have to do both to get the full picture of what's going on when we talk about relevance. So just to give you a brief sense of who I am, I run a small museum of art and history about an hour and a half south of here in Santa Cruz, California. And we have really worked hard to be very relevant to our whole community, to our diverse community in Santa Cruz County, and to be a vibrant community center for our community. This is what the museum looks like on the outside right now. If you haven't been to Santa Cruz, this picture gives you a sense of the fact that we are a hippie town, a surf town. But this is not what the museum looked like when I came to become its director 5.5 years ago. When I came in May of 2011, we had two really big problems. The first was money. We didn't have any. The day I walked in as our new director, we had $16,000 in the bank, we had $36,000 in unpaid bills, and there was no endowment or secret check on its way. The board was talking about closing the doors of the museum. At the same time, we had, in my opinion, an even bigger problem, which was that not a whole lot of people cared or knew that. In fact, in our case, more people, I believe, in our county knew that this used to be the county jail than knew it was now a museum. And at this point, it had been a museum for 20 years. And it was in the space of this dual crisis, a financial crisis and a relevance crisis, that the board of the museum decided to take a risk. And they said, we are going to try and do something different and be something different in our community, and we are going to take a chance and hire a 29-year-old exhibit designer with no management experience, no fundraising experience, no art and no history background professionally to run this place and to take us in a new direction. And over the last few years, we have dramatically changed what this museum is and what it does in our community. And we've done so focusing on a couple of things. This idea of activating the museum as a gathering place in our community. And I'll just say we call it the MA, the Museum of Art and History, so you'll see that word. That instead of saying we have the objects, we have the stories, we have the art inside here and we're here to give it to you, saying that the creativity and the culture and the art and history of our community lives beyond our walls, and it's our job to go find that art and history, invite it into this space, ignite it in our space. And we do these things to invite people to bond with people who they love, but more importantly, to build bridges across differences, across social differences, but also across cultural differences. And we look at that both with people and with content. We want you to come to the museum to learn about something that you didn't know before and to meet somebody who was different from you, not to reinforce your self-concept and the cultural experiences you're already clear on. And then finally, we talk about this idea not of learning, but of empowerment, and that we want people to walk out feeling that they can make art and they can make history in their own lives as well. We put all these ideas together into this one-page theory of change, this playbook for what we do and what we're trying to achieve. Everybody on our team has this piece of paper taped next to their desk somewhere, and it's become a very effective way for us to keep our mission at the heart of how we plan and evaluate our programming. And what I really care about, and I know this is hard to read, and we're not going to talk through this, but the very last statement on it is our impact statement. We have changed our museum not by building a new building, not by changing our programs, although we certainly did that, but by changing the purpose of why we exist and what we're trying to do. And we now say our goal in our community is to build a stronger and more connected community and to use art and history as instruments of that change. Now, you know, this all sounds very politically and maybe socially inspiring, but as an executive director, of course, I also care about the numbers. Here's some of what that change has looked like in terms of numbers for us. So more than tripling our attendance, more than doubling our staff, more than doubling our budget, and going from that $16,000 in the bank and unsure about making payroll to being able to build and grow in our community. One thing that's hard to see here is one of the things we're most proud of is that those participants, those 60,000 people a year, now reflect the full age, income, and ethnic diversity of our city, and that's the measure we use for success. Also say, if you don't know, Santa Cruz is a town of about 65,000 people, so most people in our community are involved with the museum now in some way. So as an executive director, of course, I am happy about these numbers. They, you know, allow me to sleep at night. But they also have brought up some real questions. Questions simply like, who are all these people who now find this place to be meaningful to them but did not 6 years ago? And there are those of us who support the museum, who work at the museum, our board, our participants, who are excited about this transformation. And there are also critics who say, sure, all these new people are coming in the door, but you've just made it a party space. You've just made it a fun place. Is the art and the history still at the heart of what you do? What is relevant to these people? Why are they deciding to be here? And it's in that context that I started really diving into this question of relevance. Are these people here because the social experience is relevant to them? Are they involved because we're taking our programming and our experiences with art and history out into places where they are with unorthodox partners and programs? Or is it about the content, that we're using the same form of a museum, but changing which artists, which stories we put on the wall, who is empowered in our space to think of their art and history belonging in a museum? And it's in the context of all of these questions that I started writing this book, because I wanted to really understand what had gone on for us, but also what had gone on for hundreds of other organizations around the world tackling these same challenges, which I know many of you are as well. So I thought what I'd do today is share with you four of the things that I've been diving into around this idea of relevance, and then we'll open it up for discussion and take it wherever you want to go. So obviously the first thing we need to do if we want to talk about defining and talking about relevance is to define it. And the first thing that really became apparent to me in learning more about relevance is that nothing is universally relevant. You know, not the Cubs winning the World Series, not Beyonce, and certainly not libraries and museums. I think that I work with a lot of people who are so committed and will say things like, Shakespeare is relevant to everyone because it illuminates the human condition, or climate change is relevant to everyone because we all live on this planet. And it's true that Shakespeare is valuable and that climate change is important, but it doesn't necessarily make them relevant. We all choose as individuals every day what we decide is relevant to us, what we're going to attend to, and what we're going to ignore. And no institution can assign relevance by fiat. So how do we as individuals make those decisions? Researchers who study relevance and how we absorb information have basically said there are two criteria that make information relevant. The first is the idea that it generates a positive cognitive effect. Now, the idea, the word positive here doesn't necessarily mean it makes you happier. It's just that you're getting an aha moment. There's some meaning you're getting from the experience. And then the second criteria is about effort. That the more effort it takes to get that meaning, the more likely people are to feel that it's irrelevant to them. It doesn't make the meaning less valuable, but it makes it something that's harder for them to get to. And let me give you an example. How many people in here like bacon? Okay, it's kind of the front of the room. So I'm a vegetarian, and I have spent pretty much my whole adult life trying to convince the people who love me most that maybe eating meat is not the best option for their health. And they have basically ignored me. And so it was totally fascinating to me last year when you may recall that the World Health Organization put out this study saying that cured meats, like bacon, are in the same carcinogenic category as asbestos and cigarettes. Of course, that wasn't the headline that you saw. The headline you saw was bacon causes cancer. And all over the world, all over the news media, all over the internet, this news blew up. I remember going to the dentist, and the hygienist who was cleaning my teeth told me she had seen this news, and she and her teenage son had instantly decided to stop eating meat. And I looked at her in disbelief because here I was, I had spent years trying to give people the exact same information, people who love me most, and them ignoring it. And I wondered, you know, what's going on here? And I think that this idea that bacon causes cancer, while it is not positive to people who love bacon, generates a very strong positive cognitive effect. When something you love is connected to something you hate, there is a very big aha moment that happens there. And so for a lot of people, they were having this meaning moment that was new for them. Now, of course, the problem with this information is when you get to the second criteria of effort and you find that a lot of people might get the meaning and then decide, you know what, I'm going to just put that aside because it's too much effort for me to change the way I live. Now, when it comes to bacon, we can kind of chuckle at this, but I would submit to you that we are having this experience all the time in our work, that we are trying to invite our communities to feel that what we feel is meaningful might be meaningful to them. And they either are not hearing it in a way that is going to make that aha, that cognitive effect for them, or it sounds like too much effort for them to figure out what might be behind the door of our institutions. And it's in the context of these two criteria that I've started working with this working definition of relevance, which is this idea that relevance is a key that unlocks meaning. It's not equivalent to meaning, but if you imagine that the work that you do lives inside a room, whether that's a physical room like this space we're in, or whether it's a metaphor, room, that there are people who love what you do. Your members, your donors, your supporters, they have keys to your door. They walk up to the door any day, they take out their key, they open the door, they walk into the room, they put the key back in their pocket, they don't even think about it. They are in the place that they love, where they get meaning and value, and they're going to keep participating. But for people who are on the outside, people who are out on the street, metaphorically or literally, they have no idea what's behind those locked doors. They don't know that there could be meaning for them. They don't know where they could find a key or if it's even worth the effort to figure it out. And so for me, I've started thinking more and more about this question of how do we, knowing that there is great meaning in my case, our museum, in your case, an Athenaeum or a library, how do we invite people to unlock that meaning in a way that they're going to find valuable? How can they find the door and the key to find a good experience, an experience that's going to be powerful for them on the inside? You know, when we talk about this idea of rooms and doors, instantly we end up talking about who's inside the room and who's outside the room. And I've been thinking about this a lot in this country this year as we go into this election. You know, in this country, there's been a ton of discussion, obviously, about the different sides and who's undecided and who could possibly be undecided. But what we don't talk about very much is the very large percentage of adults, eligible adults in this country, who choose not to vote. I presume that most people in this room, if you're an American, are planning to vote, or maybe you've already voted this year. And if you feel that way, it's because you feel that voting is relevant to you. You believe that there is meaning, that there's positive cognitive effect in casting your ballot, that maybe it's about engaging in a participatory democracy, maybe it's about the sense that, you know, you have something to contribute to our community, but there is meaning for you there. And the effort, registering, showing up, standing in line, it's worth it. It may be complicated, but you know how to do it. Now, in this country, somewhere between 25 and 35% of adults, eligible adults, don't vote. Why is that? You know, I really don't think it's because they're disinterested or because they're stupid. I think that when you think about this definition, I think that they really don't think voting is relevant to them. We've certainly heard a lot in this country about people who are having doors systematically slammed in their faces. When you think about the effort side of this equation, they can't figure out or they're not able to get to the place and the opportunity to vote. And that effort issue is real. But the meaning issue is real, too. You know, I don't know about you, but I have some friends who don't vote, and when you ask them why, they say, I don't feel like my voice matters. I don't feel like the things that are on the ballot allow me to speak to the issues in my community that matter most to me. They don't see meaning inside the room, and they're not going to try and open that door. So how do you change that? That's the question that Yossi Sargent was posing to himself when he got hired by the Barack Obama campaign in 2007. He had been selling cars for a living, Scions, to young urban people of color in this country, and he got so turned on by the message of Barack Obama, he stopped selling cars and he went to the campaign. And he got there, and the campaign folks said, we're so glad you're here, because the only way we're going to win this election is if people who have not historically voted turn out to vote. Young people, urban people, people of color. And Yossi said, great, that's why I'm here. He said, you know, I'm new to politics. Where do I start? And they said to him, go get an endorsement from the Fresno Bee. And he looked at his bosses in disbelief. Because he may not have known much about politics, but Yossi knew that getting a newspaper endorsement from a small regional agricultural town in the middle of California was not going to be the path to inviting these people who had been outsiders to voting to vote this year. And he said, you know what, I have a different idea. And he called a friend of his, Shepard Ferry, a graffiti artist, and a fellow supporter of Barack Obama, and said, hey, could we do something together to show our support? And this Manifest Hope campaign was born. You know, now we look back and we think about this campaign just in terms of this poster, but Manifest Hope was this huge movement that Yossi helped orchestrate of artists, of musicians, of all kinds of people who were speaking to the relevance of voting in a new way. And when we look back now at this election, regardless of how you feel about Barack Obama, people say it was a success because young people came and they saw an opportunity for that door and that room to be meaningful for them, and they walked in and they voted. But I want to invite you for a moment to put yourself in the shoes of Yossi's supervisors when he said to them, you know, I need $50,000 to rent a warehouse to do an exhibition of street art related to this idea of hope, or I need a line item in my budget for MCs. And, you know, from his supervisors' perspectives, those people who told him to go get that newspaper endorsement, it was very perplexing to imagine how these activities were going to lead to the result that they wanted of turning out the vote. And I think that one of the real challenges we have whenever we're trying to make the work that we are passionate about relevant to somebody who's an outsider is that the things that work for us, the doors we are so comfortable walking through, are either locked or invisible to those people who are not coming in. I think we have this fallacious idea that we're going to start with the organization we have, with the programming and the institution and the doors we have, and all we need to do to bring in new people is just open those doors wider. In my experience, this doesn't work because it's not because of how long the doors are open that people are choosing not to come in. They're choosing not to come in because there's something about the center of what's happening that is not speaking to them and is not inviting them in. In our case, at our institution, our growth looked more like this. We, you know, started with this traditional museum, and the way we grew was by opening new doors in new directions. And I'll say there's both a safe and a scary side to this image. The safe side is this. Most of the Purple Circle people stayed. Most of our insiders who had loved a traditional, sleepy museum of art and history loved seeing young people, people of color, different kinds of energy coming into the museum, loved seeing an institution they cared about solvent, loved seeing the museum live and breathe in a new way in our community. Most of them stayed. However, there is a scary side to this picture, which is that to do this work and to invite in all that new people and energy, we had to take perfectly nice walls and say, we're going to turn these into a construction site and we're going to build doors out here. In fact, we're going to recenter a lot of our programming outside of what has traditionally been in our room. And I want to give you a quick example of that. So this is a poster from the very first pop-up museum we ever did. A pop-up museum is a museum that anybody can create on any theme. People bring their own objects on that theme, handwrite labels for it, you lay it out on tables, and boom, you have an instant museum. If you're interested in this format, there's a website, popupmuseum.org, and a toolkit. I was just looking at it last week, and people in over 200 countries have now made pop-up museums, which is pretty cool. But this is a poster from the very first one, and it was done the night before Valentine's Day at a bar, and the theme was F my ex. It says, bring an object or piece of art from a failed relationship and mend your heart. So you brought your object, you told your story, there were drink specials. It was very successful. And I think you can probably imagine as we walked around on the street of this college town with this flyer, how there were some people for whom this was a key to a door they had not known existed. And they said, wow, I didn't know we had a museum, or wow, this looks fun, I'm going to come and do this. I think you can also imagine some of our Purple Circle people, our insiders, who were distressed by this. I have learned, by the way, that the letter F alone on a flyer is just a bad idea. But more seriously, we heard from people who said, you know, the irreverence of this, the ephemerality of the program runs counter to what I think a museum is fundamentally about. And I invited the intern who was running this program to write a blog post about some of this debate about this poster on our website. And we got this really interesting comment in from a guy who said, I'm closer to the stodgy traditional museum supporter than to the audiences you're currently trying to reach, but I strongly support your outreach and attempts to involve new communities. It is precisely because of that outreach that I finally became a museum member last year. There was no reason to do so before, since the museum, in his opinion, was doing nothing. I still have little occasion to go to the museum, but I'm willing to support it as an important community resource. I think this is so interesting because this is this guy saying, I'm a Purple Circle person for whom that Purple Circle museum was not relevant. And the reason you are relevant to me is not for me to have art and history experiences, but it's because you are serving this purpose in our community, helping build a stronger community, and I want to walk into that door and be part of that room and part of that. Now, obviously, this is a kind of positive story, but this tension continues at our museum every day. This is one of my favorite comment cards we've ever had. One person writes, what is this, community center or museum? And somebody else wrote, can't it be both? And I think that as we tackle these challenges of the needs and wants of insiders and the needs and wants of outsiders, we try always to take this attitude of being an institution of and, not choosing, are we going to be for you or are we going to be for you, but as much as possible saying, can't it be both? Can't we create a bigger room together for all the experiences people want to have in this institution? Sometimes people really react, and frankly, when insiders say things that are blatantly discriminatory, it's actually fairly easy for us to show them the door and say, you know what, yeah, I'm okay if you don't find a place for yourself in this room. But actually, the more interesting and more challenging insider ideas we come up with are insiders who struggle to just understand, what are these new doors about? This is when we were building our theory of change, and we were talking about this idea of art and history being vehicles of empowerment. This trustee said, you know, well, when I go to museums, I don't go to be empowered. And I had to turn to her and say, Cynthia, you are the mayor of Santa Cruz. I'm pretty sure you have a lot of opportunities to be empowered in this community. And I think that one of the challenges of making this kind of change is that often, even as you're expressing intention and desire for outsiders to come in, the voices you hear are the voices of insiders who are confused or feel maybe attacked by some of these potentials to take those walls and turn them into doors. And one of the things that I've constantly tried to do is to focus on those outsiders for whom we're building those doors. And those are people like Jasmine. Jasmine is actually a young librarian in Santa Cruz County. And this is from an email that she sent out to our membership last year. She says, growing up in LA, I was surrounded by my culture. There were constant reminders of who I am. Santa Cruz always felt that something was missing, that parts of me were missing, even after living here for 7 years. The Ma is special to me because it fills that gap. It reflects my story, my history, and my culture. And Jasmine goes on to talk about how, as a young Latina, she is finding a place of belonging for her creativity, her culture, her story in this museum that she hasn't felt for the 7 years she's lived in our community. And when we have to make choices, or choices, I am always going to choose to empower and create a sense of belonging for somebody who doesn't feel it anywhere else, as opposed to continuing to empower somebody who has power already in our community. And I feel like as vehicles of public service, we should be making those decisions always to say, how do we invite in and create a place for the Jasmines, even if it means frustrating, confusing, upsetting some of the people who have had the power historically inside? How do you do that? How do you find those outsiders? How do you find those Jasmines if they're not inside? I mean, the obvious answer is to leave the building. And I think that for us at our institution, our work has been absolutely driven with the idea that we need to not imagine the communities of interest for us, but we need to go out and spend time with them and understand where is art and history in your world, where are creativity and culture relevant to you, and how can we make our museum a place that reflects and invites you to experience that here. Some of the people who have been the greatest heroes to me in this work are those outsiders who have become insiders in different institutions, who are the bridge walkers who are saying, here's where we need to build this door, or that's not working right, or let me help open this door for new people. This is, for me, fundamentally about the fact that relevance, again, it's not about us on the inside and what we think somebody might want or should want, but about what is going to invite them into a place of learning or connection or whatever it is you're doing in your institution. This is one of my heroes in this work. This is Betty Reed Soskin. Does anybody know who she is? Definitely worth learning more about. She's just across the bay here in Richmond, California. And she's famous in this country because she is the oldest park ranger in the National Park Service. She's in her 90s now. She became a park ranger when she was in her 80s, when they were building a new park right across the river, right across the bay here, focused on people who worked in the shipyards of Richmond, California to build during the World War II war effort. Betty actually was a 19-year-old working in the segregated shipyards at that time, and in her 80s, she got involved in the planning of this park and was inspired to put on the uniform and interpret and storytell at this park, which she does to this day. And Betty talks about the fact that one of the things that she does that's unusual, and there are many things about this extraordinary woman that are unusual, is she says, you know, I don't just wear this uniform, this Park Service uniform, when I'm at the park. I wear it when I'm in Oakland, when I'm in Richmond, and when I'm out in the city. And she says, the reason I do that is because when I wear this uniform walking down the street, I am announcing to young people of color a career path and an opportunity that I didn't know was for me until I was in my 80s. And Lord knows I don't want other people to have to wait that long to figure that out. For her, her uniform, for Betty, her uniform is a key and a way to invite people into a door of an experience that has newly become meaningful to her. But one of the things that's interesting about this work and complex about it is that every community is different, right? And so I want to introduce you to another one of my heroes in the Park Service. This is Cam Juarez. Cam works in Tucson, Arizona at Saguaro National Park. And he's the first community organizer ever hired by the Park Service. And he was hired specifically to work with the local Latino population in Tucson to invite them to be part of the national park. And one of the first things Cam said when he came was, he said, you know, for my community, for Latinos living near the border, this uniform is not an open door. This uniform is a keep out sign. And in every community, there are some things that we do institutionally that are going to read as welcome, come on in. And there are some things we do that are going to read as keep out. And when you're working with different communities, we have to honor the fact that for different people, those are different things. So the way we deal with that at our institution is by working with lots of partners from throughout our community to understand better what feels like an open door and what feels like a keep out for them. These are 40 of the members of the Creative Leadership Committee that we run in Santa Cruz County, and these include people like UC Santa Cruz professors and county supervisors and organizational leaders, but it also includes people like the local representative of the Ohlone community and Native population, people who run a bike church, people who run a fabric collective, people who run a tech program for young migrant workers, all different kinds of culture bearers and networked people in our community, each of whom is a representative of a community who we care about and want to be involved with. But we know that we can't do that just by going out. We have to invite and connect and figure out how to bring in. And I think that the hardest part of this work, actually, is when you hear from an outsider, hey, this is something that doesn't work for me, and you have to decide, are we willing to change? Are we willing to take off that flat hat that we have been so proud of for so long, or whatever other convention of your institution may be of extreme importance on the inside, but be a real limiter when you're thinking about those people on the outside you're trying to invite? And one of the institutions that's inspired me in this way is the State Library of Queensland in Brisbane. I realize there are a lot of Australians in the room. Has anybody been to this library? Yeah. It's a beautiful place. I was lucky to be there when it opened. It is a gleaming contemporary building, big open plan, white, and a real sense of energy and innovation in the space. And when they opened, they said, you know, we want to be a library for the Indigenous people in Queensland as well. And we want to create an Indigenous knowledge center, what they ended up calling a Kuruldagan, that really honors the ways that Aboriginal people want to learn and share knowledge in this library too. And I was there as an exhibit designer at the time, who had been invited to be part of this workshop with librarians, designers, architects, and Aboriginal leaders and elders to talk about how this space might be created. And we're sitting in this white, gleaming, open plan, super contemporary space, and the very first thing that happens is the Aboriginal elders say, you know, for us, learning and sharing knowledge doesn't happen strictly around books. Actually, primarily it happens around music and dance. It happens in an intergenerational way, and it needs to happen in a colorful space. It can't be so sterile. And you could see librarians looking around at their beautiful, white, gleaming space that they had just opened, incredibly proud of, and seeing it a little bit in new eyes. And then the next thing that happened was that the Native elders said, you know, and the most important ways we share knowledge actually can't happen indoors because they have to happen around a fire. And you could see the librarians at this moment, right? Making this decision in their head. Is this for real? Do we want to really open new doors that will make this a meaningful library for these Aboriginal people in our community? Or do we just wish that they would come through the beautiful gleaming doors that we have already built for this state? And to their great credit, they decided, yes, it is for real. And they took one of those white gleaming spaces and made it a colorful intergenerational space for music or dance. And even more impressively, they found an outdoor space where they were able to build this fire pit. This is an image from an international congress of Indigenous youth who decided to meet at the State Library of Queensland because it was a place for the knowledge sharing and learning and leadership development that was powerful for this group. Finally, you know, to me, this question, what is in our room currently? What doors do we have? Who do they open to? Can really, for me at least, go far in thinking about how do we decide who we want to be, who we want to be for, and if we want to change some of that, how are we going to do it? You know, I come from the arts, from museums, and many arts organizations have front doors that are really coded for a particular kind of person and a particular kind of experience. They're gorgeous and they're powerful, but they're doors that only open to some. And I think that as we are thinking about opening new doors, we can't make them doors that are like the back door for the help. We have to give as much love and respect and beauty to those new doors as we have to these traditional ones. I think one of the challenges that happens, especially at larger institutions, is that sometimes we end up kind of building motels where we end up having different programs and different doors. Deborah and I were talking earlier about the chess club here and about how in some institutions, and I'm not suggesting this is happening here, but in some institutions we can get in a place where we say the way we're going to invite different people in is we're going to have this program for this people, and it happens at this time in this space with this kind of personality, and we're going to have this time and this space for these people, and they don't overlap. And especially when I work with people who are in very big institutions, you often end up in a world where the library, the development department, the archives, the youth program, they are like entirely different rooms. And they may sure be connected with an infrastructure on the back, but to the people walking in, they're trapped into these little rooms of these different experiences. I think that's unfortunate for the people walking in our doors that we're not able to invite them into all the meaning of all the good stuff we have. And I think it's also unfortunate on the inside that then we end up having these arguments about which is the real door, which is the good room, which room are we going to put new furniture in, and we're not able to talk more generously and more generatively about the big room that we're creating together. Of course, I think some of the worst things that happen, and I doubt very much this happens too much with you guys, is there are a lot of institutions that get so caught up in a marketing idea about inviting new people in that they actually paint up these false doors on walls, and they say, come on in, this is for you, and people run in, and they slam their heads on the wall, and they walk away wondering, man, what happened? And we on the inside say, well, why didn't they come back? You know, I work with a lot of institutions where they may have a vanishing door that exists just once a year. Oh, we're having Dragon Festival. Come on in, Chinese families. Oh, Dragon Festival's over. We'll see you next year. And there is this sense that we expect that those doors were opening only for a short time or maybe to a very parsimonious part of what we do should be sufficient. But I believe they're not sufficient. And I believe that if what we really want to do is invite people into the meaning and the power and all the good stuff inside our institutions, we need to be as generous as possible about saying, and as courageous as possible about saying, let's build a new door to invite in this group who we really care about. And let's invite them not just into a small part of what we do, but into everything that we do. And behind the scenes, let's work together to make this a bigger room for our community. I truly believe that if we can do this work, we can build rooms full of power and meaning for so many of our communities and build bigger rooms together. Thank you. So I think we have about 10 minutes for questions or discussion, critiques, concerns, and I think there's one right next to you, Deborah.
Nina, thanks so much. That was a wonderful, engaging delivery.
Thank you.
In your entry into this organisation and the vision that you obviously had and built with others, how did you go about saying what were your first priorities and in almost like what was your plan, your strategic plan, or did it evolve over time? So I'd just like a little bit about your journey in that
way. Yeah, absolutely. Well, in our case, you know, somebody once said to me, a crisis is a terrible thing to waste. And I agree that in our case, coming in this point of crisis meant that the very first part before I came in was the board saying, this needs to be different. And them saying, they wrote this vision statement that had these four key words, you know, a thriving central gathering place. We want to make this a thriving central gathering place. And so when I was hired, the very first thing was trying not to say, this is my vision and my idea of what we should do, but always saying, how can we make this thing that you have written and voted on, this thriving central gathering place, real? And when we had successes, even if they were unsure about them, always saying, oh, we're executing on that thing that you decided. So first of all, using the cover and the wind of something that they had designated, not me, was very important. And then from a kind of strategy perspective, you know, we were in this crisis moment, right? We had no money. I laid people off my first week. We all took salary cuts. I mean, it was really dire. But I also knew that we couldn't raise money and we couldn't engage people just by kind of a gloom and doom, help save us kind of thing. And so what we did was we started as as quickly as possible, incubating a lot of kind of glimpses of the future we wanted to build. We brought on a whole lot of interns and just kind of said, our goal is to make this a thriving central gathering place around art and history, open season. If it involves no money or maybe $5, go for it. And we had a very chaotic programming time in my beginning, and we were able through that to start showing people, here's the kind of place we intend to be. And then when people would complain and say, gosh, you brought in these couches, but they look like you got them off the side of the street. And we'd say, yes, we did get them off the side of the street, but people like sitting in them. Wouldn't you like to buy us nicer couches? And I feel like there was a sense from my perspective that if we had planned and then executed, A, we would have run out of money, but B, people wouldn't have believed the plan could be real. And instead, by just starting in these little ways to get some things going, we started showing people, here's what we're trying to achieve. Won't you help us fuel this? And actually, very early on, as we were doing all these crazy kind of programmatic explorations, I was also working with some donors and community leaders to start to flesh out a plan for what became a million-dollar campaign that they named Renewed Ambition. And they really became believers in those first few months, seeing the wacky things we were doing, that we were able to renew the ambition of the organization, and that there was an opportunity for them to be involved in doing so. So I think there was this kind of scrappy, intern-led activity going on at the same time as I was going to donors and saying, here's what we're trying to do. Let's do this together. Yeah.
You got donations and you got help from the community and from donors generally. How did you generate your own income to then come to a stage where you're sustainable without donations?
We will never be sustainable without donations. So like most museums in this country, we are a private nonprofit. What's unusual about us is we actually don't... ticket sales and things like that is a teeny tiny part of our budget. It's basically a rounding error. But membership is very big, which I know is something that's common in this room, and donations. And I think that we've taken the stance that we are an organization that is here to use art and history, creativity and culture to build community, just as there might be an environmental organization that exists to make our waterways cleaner, just as there might be a homeless service center to help, you know, take care of people in need, that we exist in that public benefit world. And it has actually helped us be more successful or to reach donors for a different reason, not because, oh, I love this kind of art and won't you show an exhibit of this thing that I love and I'll help fund it, which is kind of common in this country with museums, but instead, oh, I love this community and I see that you're helping make this community better, so I'm going to fund it. So I feel that it is more sustainable, although it is still very individual and grant, you know, it's still very donor driven in terms of the funding model. But I always feel like, you know, if in this country at least the money for art is here and the money for history is here and maybe the money for education is here, the money for making your community a better place is like much bigger pot. And so I feel like we're able to access and connect with more people and more dollars than we would be in a more traditional kind of setup.
Unfortunately, in the UK, we do live on some donations and grants, but we have to be sustainable independently
as
well.
Yeah, yeah. With earned income, you mean? Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, wait, hold on just a sec. Let me get this, because we're recording, okay?
Oh.
Thanks. How does your current budget break down in terms of earned income, earned from membership fees or rentals, number one? Number two, private donations from individuals, businesses, private charitable foundations, that's number two. And number three, government or public sources?
Yeah. So, you know, I mentioned in the very beginning that our building used to be the county jail. So we have an unusual situation, which is wonderful, which actually I wouldn't be surprised if some people in this room have, which is we have real estate. So the building where the museum is attached to a bigger part of a building that we operate as commercial real estate. So while we don't have, say, we're not a government line item, you know, to get unrestricted funds. We do operate real estate that generates some unrestricted funds. So whether you consider that earned income or government, you know, in our case, we're right now at about a $1.6 million budget. The building's probably generating $250,000 a year. Our membership, tickets, facility rental, membership, at least in our case, there's a real debate about are those donations or is that earned? But, you know, that's another maybe $400,000. And then the remaining $1 million would be from individual contributions and grants. And so, but again, especially because we focus so much on audience diversity, we don't want to price people out of experiencing the museum. We actually have a policy we call spontaneous free, where if you walk in the building and you walk up to the desk and take out your wallet, we'll take your money. But if you walk in and you're kind of looking around like, what is this place? I'm not sure. We've empowered our front desk team to always say, oh, have you ever been here before? Come on in and check it out. Please be my guest and let me know on the way out what you think. And I actually learned that from a librarian who once said to me, the best way I can make a library patron for life is by waiving their fines. And this sense of creating a gift culture, and also for us on a practical perspective, if you have made it in our building, we don't want you to not come in because you're unsure about spending $5 on a ticket. And so I think that we've had this real perspective of we want to be the kind of organization where the experiences exist for everybody in our community, and then there are a group of people who are also deciding at varying levels to give more to make that possible. So it's like a public radio model in our way. Yeah. There's a guy right in front of you, and then we'll go to you. Yeah.
No, you go.
Okay.
Thank you for this. It's been really great. I'm in Cincinnati, and we have had we had the same problem you had when you first came. You know, a long time membership that didn't change very much, and so we've been adding nights, doing more events, and kind of targeting audiences to get them through the door. And ultimately, of course, the goal is going to be to, you know, more mingling. Do you anticipate a problem for my library if too often, you know, we get one crowd and then the next night it's a different crowd? And obviously for the third event, I'd like both of those crowds to be together. Is there a danger point? Is there a tipping point where it's going to happen? Or is there a point where I'm going to say, oh, Wednesday nights, kids' nights, Thursday nights, gay nights, Friday nights, black night. I don't want that.
Right. What a great question. Yeah, it's one of the reasons that we've really focused on social bridging as one of our primary goals. We wanted also to avoid that. And frankly, in our case, there's also this practical sense of we're in a small enough community. You know, here in San Francisco, for example, you can have a young professional's night and pack the California Academies of Sciences and not worry that disenfranchising those families or older adults is going to mean you can't be successful. In our community, if we're inviting in only a narrow target, that's a small part of our community. And so, but from a kind of social mission perspective, we really said we want to be the place where you encounter people who are not like you. And so often I think what ends up working well is you invite people in through a door that's going to be very comfortable for them. You know, we, for example, with teens, started with by teens for teens teen nights. But then we felt that it was both a disservice to the teens and to the rest of our community to not try and intentionally create some of those bridges. And so as teens started feeling more comfortable at the museum, actually they came to us and said, hey, we want a program for more people. It doesn't need to be just for teens. And I think that not trying to deliberately break down, as you start to see those walls, those motel rooms start to build up, trying to deliberately break those down and say, hey, let's come together, isn't a good thing. And, you know, I will say, social bridging and also cultural bridging, there are some real negatives to it for people who want a bonded experience. And so, you know, I always use the example, we did a music festival a long time ago, and we said, you know what, we're going to program the main stage is going to be opera, then hip-hop, then ukulele, then choral. And we knew that the opera people being right with the hip-hop people made each of those groups have a less good opera experience or hip-hop experience. But we also knew that we are not an opera or a hip-hop venue, and we are a venue that's about opera and hip-hop coming together and us exploring the like rich creative collisions and intersections of different cultural practice. And so we have been comfortable saying, we're comfortable if you have a less good bonded experience, if it means that you have a bridging experience you're not having anywhere else. And frankly, I think that in this day and age, at least in this country, we have fewer and fewer opportunities to bridge. You know, there's a lot of research about this, and more opportunities to be with people who are just like us. We've found, you know, and this has contributed to our funding model as well, people find extraordinary value in the sense that, wow, when I come to the MA, I know that I'm going to feel positive and safe encountering people who are different from me. I was just at an event yesterday, and this woman from Orange County, which is down in Southern California, was talking about, she was this like beautifully coiffed, wealthy white woman who was talking about, she said, you know, I visited your museum a couple years ago. We were just chatting at an event, and she said, and I was playing with this art thing, and I was moving these balls around, and there was this man who came up, and we started doing it together, and we started talking, and he was homeless. And she said, I never have had experience with a homeless person like that before, and she said, it really stuck with me. And you know, and I immediately have this moment of like, oh, I should be asking you for money. But but we are really hearing from people, if you can do this in a way that is intentional and feels safe and feels and is grounded in a cultural or learning experience, that there's extraordinary power there, because you're not getting that in other places in society. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. That was a really great talk. And you make it seem like what you do in program is a very spontaneous thing, which I'm sure it isn't.
Sure.
I think there's probably a lot of planning. But I was interested if you could maybe talk about how that programming experience works, particularly with your... You mentioned that there are 40 people in your creative leadership community.
Yeah.
How do you wrangle that?
Yeah, so we have a programming model. Yes, thank you. It is very planned, and we're always kind of grappling with how do you be responsive to your community and get to a system that really works. But our core programming model is what we call community-first programming. So we say, who's the community of interest with whom we want to be engaging? Work with some people from that community to say, what are the cultural assets and needs in this community? So what are you seeking, but also what are you proud of? And then how can we build projects out of that? So, for example, today when I drive back, it's our Dia de los Muertos Festival. It's a huge, you know, Mexican-rooted festival celebrating and honoring the dead. And so that event really came out of our interest in working with local Oaxacan communities and then, you know, just kind of finding out, hey, who are the leaders in these communities? Where is Dia de los Muertos happening here yet? Is it not? How do we do this in a way that's not culturally appropriative? And so finding, it was only a few hops to find, oh, this is the group that does amazing music and dance but doesn't have a visual arts component to what they do. And so they've wanted to do a festival, but they haven't been able to do the altars. And being able to come together and reach out to them and say, hey, we're kind of interested in doing something with Dia de los Muertos. We run this historic cemetery. Are you interested in this? And being able to build a project together. So it's not always that discreet in terms of saying this community of Oaxacan culture bearers, let's come together. But that intention comes through everything we do in terms of looking at who's currently coming, what are the communities of interest for us, which may be demographically defined, but often are defined by things like people who are involved in maker culture or young parents or, you know, people who are unemployed and trying to figure out what to do during the day. So it's not always rooted in kind of those demographic numbers, but and then trying to figure out who's working in that space and how do we build that together. So that creative leadership committee, they're organized each year around a theme. Last year the theme was cultural bridging. This year the theme is about youth stepping into their own power. And we have a couple of anchor projects. We're doing an exhibition with former foster youth about their experience and with a couple other social service agencies. And it was pretty easy in that case to say, okay, we know we're focusing on teens who are really struggling. And you know, to pick up the proverbial phone book and figure out who's working in that space, who's credible, who's trusted in that space. And one thing I experience, which I would imagine would work in your cases as well, is especially somebody from social services, you know, when I call up somebody in child protective services or the juvenile hall and say, hey, we're really interested in learning more about how we can empower teenagers in our community to use the creativity inside of them to build positive futures for themselves and their community, they are so thrilled and can't believe it. And they're working so hard on the kind of crisis of the moment. I always say, you know, art opens a window, that it's not that we're going to solve the problem coming in their front door, but they have no slack to do the kind of creative exploration that they really are energized by. And so we found we have a very credible role to play as a partner in that kind of way. I'm going to close it. Thank you. I'll just say
you.
I have some books. Happy to sign them. No shipping, no tax. And they're $25. I can take cash or credit cards. And thank you.
You.
Thank you for having me. Yeah.